Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
Well, nobody better than Bryan Cranston, and that guy is going to be on here for the next hour or so. A very revealing, interesting email, or so I should say interview. Plus, Sonny Carolla is a massive Breaking Bad fan, so I brought him in and he loaded up a couple of questions that Cranston was very generous to offer in a very meaningful way. So we have all that coming. First, I'll tell you about NetSuite. By Oracle, America's ready to get back to work, but you need to win in the new economy. And that means you need every advantage, and that's where NetSuite comes in. Smart companies run on NetSuite by Oracle, the world's number one cloud-based business system. With NetSuite, you have visibility and control over your financials, HR, inventory, e-commerce, and more, all in one place, whether you're a $1 million company or your company's doing hundreds of millions in sales, NetSuite, they are your advantage, and take advantage of them. Let them manage every penny and give you the agility to compete with anyone and work from anywhere, even do it from your phone. You don't have to be in your office. Join the 20,000 plus companies who trust NetSuite. Right, Dawson?
NetSuite surveyed hundreds of business leaders and assembled a playbook of the top strategies they're using as America reopens for business. Receive your free guide, 7 actions businesses need to take now, and schedule your free product tour at netsuite.com/Adam. Get your free guide and schedule your free product tour right now at netsuite.com/Adam. netsuite.com/Adam.
The Adam Carolla Show presents Bryan Cranston's Birthday Cocktail Party for March 7th. Let's see who's invited. Wanda Sykes. Jenna Fisher. From the Zombies, Chris White. He's got two questions. What's your name? Who's your daddy? J.D. Ploss is here. And Michael Eisner. NFL Hall of Famer, Lynn Swann. Author and director, Brett Easton Ellis. And the guest of honor, Bryan Cranston. Let's get back to the Adam Carolla Show.
Wow, that's a stout, that's a stacked birthday party you're having there, Bryan Cranston.
That's not a bad little company to have, is it?
No.
We're having a big bash. It's going to be 1,000 people tonight. We're celebrating my birthday late. No masks, nothing. We're all just going to dive into the COVID-filled pool.
Speaking of COVID-filled, and you tell me if this is true, but I was speaking of you as a hero earlier in the podcast, which is you contracted the disease. You did not tell anybody, I mean, in the media. You didn't go public with it. And then you went to donate platelets to help others who may have gotten this disease, and then went public when it was suggested that you could help get more people to donate if you got the word out?
Yeah. Not to name drop, but my wife and I are friends with Tom and Rita, and when they contracted it in March, and we were surprised and we were in contact with them, and then all of a sudden, just after they got it, we got it. It was weird. And Tom came out with it, and I think by him doing so, it was great. People all of a sudden went, wait a minute, fucking Tom Hanks got it, so anyone can get it. And I think really paid more attention to it, certainly more than, you know, they would be getting information from the White House. Well, and so I didn't feel it was any need to have, you know, another celebrity say, hey, I had it too. So I didn't say anything. And then Tom told me he was donating plasma, and I thought, oh, can you give me the name? And he said, yeah, here's the name. And so I started donating plasma. I'm doing it again for the third time next week. And while I was doing it, it was a new experience for me. You're sitting in this really comfortable chair for about an hour. You're watching a screen, a television, you're watching a movie or whatever, and they're drawing blood out of you and putting it into the centrifuge. It spins out the plasma, then puts the platelets back and blood back into your system. So that's and the result is this big pack, these two big packages of liquid gold, man. It's beautiful. And they said it really helps those who have it to fight it off. And then part of that plasma donation goes to the research labs. So it's like, oh, well, this is the thing I have to do. It's not even a question. So I was videotaping it, and the phlebotomist said, I remember the last time you were here, you videotaped it. And I said, yeah. And he goes, will you post that? Because our donor list has dropped off considerably, and we were hoping that maybe we can get more donors. And it's like, you know what? There it is. There's a good reason to out myself and say, I had it. And if you had it and got through to the other side and healthy now, then maybe you'll consider that. So that was the whole point.
How does the process work with the platelets? Is it blood out, blood in? Is it literally pulling it out and pushing it back in through a separate?
No, it's the same one. And actually, they're taking plasma from me. So they pull out the plasma. That's where the the antibodies live, in the plasma. And then the platelets go, which is basically your blood cells, go back into your system. But it's, I guess they draw out the blood at a certain point, then it stops, then they push back in. I'm actually not sure. I'm going to ask that next time I'm in, next week.
And you have to wait. You said it's almost time to do it again, because like I used to give blood on a regular basis, and I think you had to wait like 7 weeks or an X amount of time in between sessions. Yeah. But I don't know what the protocol is for the platelets or the plasma.
Well, the plasma, yeah. The people who have had COVID-19, who no longer are infected but have the antibodies like myself, will either get a phone call if they want you to come back in, or a letter saying thanks but no thanks. Your plasma is no longer needed for us because the antibody has diminished to a point where it's not as helpful anymore. So they called me and said, you're still good. So if you'd like, come back in. And I said, all right, let's do it. And it's like about every 3 to 4 weeks.
How did the disease, or I don't know if it's called a disease, sorry, but the COVID-19, how did it manifest itself with you and your wife? What were the symptoms? Did you feel it immediately?
I didn't. I caught it from my wife. She got it first. And she's a very diseased woman anyway. So,
wow, look, you have that much sex with Tom Hanks and eventually
it's just,
you're going to spread the disease. Now,
what? Wait, what?
Surely I can't be the first person to tell you this. It's been talked about in Hollywood for years.
It's funny. You know how when whenever you're giving blood, you remember how the nurse practitioner or the nurse is there and she's going down a list of things like, do you ever use intravenous drugs?
Right. Yeah. Have you traveled to Haiti?
Yeah. Have you ever traveled to Haiti? Have you ever had sex with a man before 1985? And I always go, wait, 1985, 1975, 1976. No. 85. Yeah. No. Just to mess with them. But we were very lucky, Adam. We had about 2 days or so of, you know, that tentative feeling you have when you feel like a flu is coming on. Mm-hmm. Your whole body feels a little achy and you feel weak. I had that for 2 days. And then I had a temperature of 99.8 for 3 hours. And then the next day that was gone. And I had one more day of, just kind of feel low, but not enough to stay in bed. I was up and walking around, but just I felt like I wanted to take a nap every hour for a week.
Well, do you think there's a correlation here? Because I've been hearing some studies, and I've always talked about it myself, which is I just sort of grew up kind of a sewer rat out in the dirt, trouncing about, never taking antibiotics. I didn't take antibiotics my entire life, you know, and just sort of, I never had real proper medical insurance, or I just kind of ride things out. Like I rode everything out. I had strep throat. I just ride it out, you know. But now I don't get sick. And I'm not allergic to anything. And I don't have, you know, I don't get acid reflux. Like, I just don't get all the commercials I see all night. I go, don't have that. Don't need a CPAP cleaning machine. And I don't get acid reflux. And I don't have antihistamines. Yes.
Erectile dysfunction. What about that?
ED, yes. Obviously, I'm going to do a commercial for. Now, I don't have anything. And I think a lot of it was rolling around in the dirt my entire life. And I know you grew up in the same dirt I grew up in, and your family was probably as dysfunctional and less as likely to get you proper medical attention as mine was. And do you get sick less than most? Do you have allergies? Is there any correlation there?
You know, some of the allergies that I've experienced now have come on since I've been an adult. One year, I was living in New York, and I was dating a really beautiful woman, and we were, like, getting along quite well. But it was only 3 months into the relationship, and my birthday shows up, March 7th, and she gives me a kitten.
Mm.
She gives me a kitten.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, I never talked about wanting a kitten. I live in an apartment in New York, and it's like, and here's a kitten. To give someone a live pet as a gift is completely out of the way. And I developed an acute allergy. I was sneezing, and my eyes were itchy, always. So I went to an allergist, and he said, well, you're allergic to many things, mostly cat dander. So I go, So I had to get rid of the cat.
Do you think her getting you a kitten is sort of the male version of you getting them lingerie? You know what I mean? It's not really for them. It's more like you want to see them in it. You know, like she wanted to hang out with the kitten in your apartment. Wasn't really so much for you.
I mean, it both involves pussy. But aside from that, let's not go down that road.
I think we're already down it.
Down that road. No, that has nothing to do with it. Here's giving someone a live animal that they were never talking about is like giving your wife a toaster for a present. It's like a functional household need, but that is not a present. My wife always says, if it has a plug, it's not a present. So it puts a little pressure on me.
So, by the way, I should explain to people that Brian has a movie out, The One and Only Ivan, which is very good. I watched it last night, and you can get it coming out soon. It's going to premiere on Disney Plus. That'll be Friday, August 21st. Brian does a fantastic job. It's a touching movie, and it's got a lot of big-name voices in it. Sam Rockwell and Angelina Jolie and Danny DeVito and Helen Mirren and many, many other recognizable voices, but Brian is doing the live action part of it. Brian is, I guess you'd be the star of the movie.
Well, not if you look at the poster. Look at the poster, right. And you know, it says and Brian Cranston. So I'm on the list, but I'm not at the top of the list.
I love your career, and the reason I love your career is because it didn't get out of the gate as, you know, like, I don't know, Leif Garrett. You weren't a big sensation when you were 22 or 27. I mean, I like these kind of perseverance meets talent meets an evolving craft kind of story, which is your career, which is the Brian Cranston story. The evolving of it, like, do you feel like you're getting better at it every year?
Well, it's certainly something that you feel like I have so much to learn, because I like to put myself in a position of something new. I don't want to do Fast and Furious 17 and just show up and drive a car and look pained and then, you know, high five someone and there's your movie. That kind of stuff bores me. So, and by the way, those are very, very successful movies. I have a habit of choosing films that I really love to do, but aren't necessarily big box office huge hits. I haven't really thought about why that is or what, but I guess I like to select films that have deepened conflicting characters, that the lead character is, or my character would be, troubled and damaged to some degree, because I can certainly relate to that. As you were alluding to before, growing up in the Valley with a middle class or lower middle class environment, my parents blew up their marriage when I was 12, and it really, really set me back. And right at the age, you think, okay, so they know what they're doing, and when I become an adult, I'll know what I'm doing. And that belief system just completely disintegrated. And so you have to kind of, it took me several steps back. So through high school, I was very quiet in high school. Not too many people knew me. And I didn't know what to do exactly. And then I stumbled on acting in college quite by accident, because I just needed an elective course. And so, but it was so much fun, and it's so engaging. And the girls were so much prettier in theater than they were in the police science course.
Yeah, you were getting into law enforcement. Were you a Monarch? Were you a L.A. Valley College guy?
Yes, yes, I was a Monarch.
Yeah, I went there for a little while, too. It was sort of a place to kind of, I found it like a place you could kind of hide out in for a couple of years so people didn't hassle you, because you could tell them you were taking college classes, but I had no idea what I was doing there. It's just sort of hiding out. But your family, so the more I sort of look at family, the scariest thing you can do to a kid is sort of seem incompetent or out of control, as I think back at it now. Like, so having a father who's very stern, or having a father that, you know, is very angry, let's say, or having a mother that's very stern or angry or depressed or anything, it's all bad. But having parents that feel out of control, like, oh my God, these people don't know what they're doing. Like, you're in a commercial airliner, and the pilot is Jim Backus, and he's just hit his head, and he's passed out.
Gilligan.
It was a mad, mad, mad world reference. But the point is, you're in a plane, and you realize the pilot doesn't know what he's doing, and you're way too young to reach the pedals, kind of thing. You know, was that, is this cathartic for me, or was that a feeling you had with your parents?
Well, I didn't know that I had that feeling about my parents until they did. So my mom was, very insecure and susceptible, very emotional, and my dad was very ego-driven. My dad was a writer and an actor, and he wasn't a star by the time he was 40, and it just really drove him crazy. And I learned from that it destroyed him effectively. It created tremendous turmoil. It blew up a marriage. The rest of his life was always, on pins and needles. It was never secure. So to live under that kind of stress was amazing. And it all stemmed from his need to achieve some level, some plateau of stardom, that I thought, oh, that's the wrong way to go about it then. So what's interesting, parents are always teaching us, constantly teaching us when we grow up. In the best of cases, they're teaching you who you should be, who you should emulate, how you should strive to better yourself. But in some cases, like in my case, they also taught me what not to be by being that way.
Yeah.
By failing at what they were doing, I realized, oh, I'm not going to be like that, because that is a one-way trip to disaster. And my mom, when my dad left the family, she was destroyed. She stopped living. She became an alcoholic. She was emotionally distraught from that point to the rest of her life.
Was it? Was she that in love with the man, or was there obviously there are other yeah. things at play? But was it just purely an obsession or love with your dad?
My mom was wonderfully spry. She was very flirtatious. She was a beautiful woman, and she was like Blanche DuBois from Streetcar Named Desire. She always depended upon the kindness of strangers. Mm-hmm. So she would pay it. She loved the attention from men. And she was married 4 times. She had scores of boyfriends. She just needed that attention. So what, in retrospect, what I realized about her is that she was also, as lovely as she was and energetic and fun, she was also tremendously insecure and immature. And that combination really hit her hard when she was left by my father for another woman. She couldn't handle it and began drinking and didn't stop drinking until she had a stroke and had to go into the motion picture hospital for the rest of her life.
When did she pass away?
In 2004, 16 years ago.
Did, we're looking at old pictures of you guys.
Yeah, that's my mom. That's me in the front.
Where are you guys at? Are you at some kind of school
Washington,
or park?
D.C. We're in Washington, D.C. You see the Capitol?
Oh, in the very back. Yeah. So I love it. Something I was talking to someone about earlier today, and I thought it'd be a good subject to get into with you, which is sort of, kind of incremental goals, which is, I think someone was saying to me, like, were you planning on being a star or having success or being rich or whatever? And I said, no, I was planning on surviving when I was about 8 or 9 to sort of get out of the, make it to junior high. And then when I got out of high school, I was dreaming about having a job, just working, And then after doing that, I started thinking about doing comedy, but I never shot past all the stages of kind of survival, or I wanted dental insurance at some point, or I wanted insurance for my pickup truck. I never shot past to stardom.
The idea of getting your own apartment was like, wow,
right.
That's cool.
Right. And so maybe that's a kind of an incremental thinking. Maybe your dad didn't do incremental thinking. Maybe he shot right to the Academy Awards and didn't do the, I need my own place and I need some stability.
Yeah. When you let ego get ahead of your progression in your field, in your talent, in your abilities, It can derail you in your actual goals. Everything takes time. Look, Malcolm Gladwell says you could become an expert if you put in 10,000 hours of service and work on any given thing. You can become an expert to it. But charlatans will always want to circumvent that and make their way. Or people who are driven by their ego. Now, my dad worked as an actor. He worked a lot as an actor, but he didn't become a star. And by not becoming a star, it made him feel that he was a failure. So when I started out acting, my goal, like you, was I want to become a working actor. If I can make my living as a working actor, and I didn't put a price tag on, there wasn't a number connected to that. Just if I can pay my bills from my acting jobs, that's my success. If I go no farther than that, I would be happy. And that happened when I was 25 years old. And because I didn't focus on making money, but just getting better, just focus on working harder and getting better at your craft, And all of a sudden, good luck started to come my way because I really loved the work. I really loved what I was doing. And I was supporting myself, my wife. She was working as an actor at the time, too. And we were able to scrape together enough to buy a little house in the valley. And we had a baby. And we're like living a very middle class environment and saving our money. And then, boom, a bunch of different things were happening in Seinfeld, and I was doing pilots, and I did a couple series that didn't go anywhere. And then when I was 40, Malcolm in the Middle happens.
What was funny when you said you're talking about your dad being 40 and not having that success, and I thought, Brian was probably around 40 at Malcolm in the Middle. I mean, is it coincidence? Is it cosmic? Is it planned? Is it planned without being conscious of a plan? I mean, your dad sort of taught you this incremental one foot in front of the other kind of this approach to this, yeah, to this very low percentage endeavor called being a paid actor. So, and I was always with you in your mindset, which is, hey, if you can get paid and you don't have to drive a taxi or work on a construction site, if you can just make a living doing something that's super low percentage, that's pretty damn good. I mean, you're way ahead of the game. It's almost like saying, you can make a living being a professional baseball player for the rest of your life. And you'd go, yeah, I would do that. And now you're not going to be on the Yankees. You're not going to start at shortstop, but you'll have a comfortable living as a professional baseball player for the rest of your life. You'd go, oh, that's the greatest job ever. Yeah. This is basically that, essentially. Yeah. And I always felt the same way.
So how old were you, Ace, when you were able to make enough money by going on the road and doing stand-up, maybe writing here and there? How old were you then?
When I started down the road to be even broader than what your goals were, and your goals were not laser-focused, but at least you had a lane, like your lane was acting. Yeah. When I was 21, 22, and I was sitting in my North Hollywood apartment on Laurel Canyon and Riverside, and I was just sitting there thinking, it's got to be more to life than driving a pickup truck and working on a construction site with a bunch of guys named Mike, because everyone was named Mike back then. It was always funny, like, where's Mike? Mike the tin knocker, Mike the sheet rocker, which Mike? Which Mike?
So it's like, cement guy.
Cement, well, on the finisher or the former? Or rebar Mike? Or pumper Mike? Who's working the pump? That Mike. Everyone's named Mike. So I was like, I got to get away from all these mics, you know? So I was just sitting around at 21, 22, and I just thought, let's do a realistic assessment. What do you think you're good at? Not what do you want to do? You want to play safety for the Rams, but that's not going to happen. What are you good at? What abilities do you have? And I said, well, I'm good with my hands and I'm a hard worker, so I'm good on a construction site and I'm funny. But I don't know what it means. All I know is I'm funny. I don't know if that means stand-up funny or work in a writer's room funny or sitcom funny. I don't know what any of it means. You're funny, almost generically funny. That's all. And I was like, all right, well, why don't you start, you know, get up and go to work tomorrow for sure and don't miss any days on the construction site. But at night, why don't you start pursuing the funny? Why don't you take some groundlings classes. I didn't know what a groundlings class was. I found somebody who told me someone's mom told me what a groundlings class was. And why don't you start, you know, taking improv classes at the church in Hollywood on Saturday morning with Mindy Sterling or whatever, Cynthia Sagetti, you know, all these people.
And I studied with both of them too.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Cynthia and Mindy.
Yes, yeah, Cynthia Sagetti, Mindy Sterling.
Right. Yeah. So yeah. I was like, go over there and throw yourself sort of on the mercy of their court, you know. And I was, you know, real blue collar, and everyone else seemed to be educated and have some kind of background and some theater and some college. And I didn't know anything, but I just said, I'll just put myself into this world. And then the next day I'd be back on the construction site, you know, and everyone would say, what are you doing? And I'd go, I'm taking an improv class. And I go, improv? Oh, yeah, like Richard Pryor's playing the improv. You know, I'd go, no, this is improvisational humor. And they go, how's it work? And they always say, how much do they pay you? And I'd go, no, you pay them. And they'd go, what? Get the fuck out. And then one of the mics would start making fun of you.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So I just did that without any sense of direction. I just said, I will go try to learn this thing. And And then eventually the Groundlings said thanks, but no thanks to me. And then I started with the Acme Theater. And then I built the Acme Theater on Lancashire and NoHo there. Yeah. And was there. And I all I was doing was kicking around and trying to learn as much as I could learn. I wasn't going on auditions. I didn't have headshots. I didn't feel like I was ready. I didn't feel like I deserved it. Like it was like the notion of, why would you go out and audition? You don't have anything to offer at this point.
Right.
That's the way I looked at it.
And so how old were you when you actually were making some money by going on the road and doing some comedy?
I didn't make any money until I was 30 and like three quarters or 31 when I'd met Jimmy Kimmel and I trained him to box for the K-Rock morning show, Kevin and Bean. And
right.
And I started getting like $50 a bit and $200 a bit or something. And then eventually I became the host or one of the hosts of Loveline in like 1996. I was like 32 and I started actually making money. And the first thing I did was pay the IRS because I owed them like $4,000 from, you know, not essentially working or right. working the way under the table and all that kind of stuff. And then I immediately started saving for a house. And then I bought my first house like a year later in the Hollywood Hills and just refurbished it and never really looked back from that point.
But it's a great feeling, isn't it? When you get to the point where I'm sure once you got on Loveline, I thought Man Show came before Loveline, but I guess not.
No, it was Loveline and then the Man Show.
Oh, okay. But didn't you have, wasn't there a feeling like, oh, I can do this. I don't feel like I am faking it. I have an ability, a talent. I can make people laugh. I can guide this show and I know my job here and I could do this. Did you have that epiphany? And so from then on, I'm good and I'll make a living in this business.
Yeah. I had a couple of thoughts. Like my thoughts were, well, this is crazy. I'm driving a car that doesn't have a lumber rack on it. You know, like I'm driving a regular car with air conditioning and stuff. Like that was a big deal, a newish car. And I'm going to my home in the hills, you know. And yep. And also the one thing I really realized is all the people that are in this business that you're working with, they don't have anything on you. They may have gotten a better start. They may be more educated. They may have more theatrical training or whatever, but they're not funnier than you are. And you couldn't really, it's hard to sit home and watch SNL or listen to the morning radio. And you have to kind of put the gloves on and get in the ring to know if you can take the champ out. And yeah. After getting in the ring and sparring with the champ, I felt like, oh, I can spar with the champ. That was my feeling. And once I kind of internalized that, I was like, okay, now you can't take it away from me because I know I have that ability.
Yeah. That is an epiphany. Yeah. You had that experience that you knew that you belonged.
And it was also weird for the first time ever. I'd have guys like Jimmy Kimmel would be going like, oh my God, you're the funniest guy I've ever met. And I'd be like, oh, really? And they'd go, oh yeah. Like I never had anyone believe in me. I know that sounds corny, but I just mean, I never heard anything like, hey man, you got a talent. You got to do something with that talent. And that wasn't anything that had ever been discussed
right.
before that.
Certainly for guys like us dealing with the mics of the world, and you really find out who your friends are because once, you know, if I told friends or acquaintances who I grew up in and around in the Valley, I said, you know, I was going to be an actor. A lot of them would go, oh, really? Yeah, you're going to be a big star. You're going to go off and be a big star. And they would choose the side that's not supportive at all, right? It's like you have those jackasses, and then you have very few who say, I bet you're going to do well. I think you're, you know, and you're maybe surprised by the ones who choose to be your support group and those. There was actually more of a majority who were very cynical about anyone wishing to break away from the pack of, you know, kids growing up in the valley, you know, just like any other little suburb in the country.
I know, it's funny. It's like you're all living in the same gulag or rowing on the same Viking ship, and you have the temerity to go, my back's sore. I'm going up top on the deck and get some fresh air. Then where are you going, Cranston? You think you're better than this Viking ship? Get down here and row.
See, you are funny, Adam. You are. You should listen to them.
That endorsement from Cranston leaves me, and it's a good segue, which is my son, now 14, Sonny, has now seen every episode of Breaking Bad and is completely obsessed with the show. And so it's also a funny thing, was I told him, I didn't even tell him, he found it. I was on a rowing machine last night, speaking of the Viking ship. I was on a rowing machine last night, and he came down to the gym I was in and my basement, and he said, Brian Cranston's going to be on the show tomorrow? And I said, yes. And he goes, you didn't tell me when Kareem Abdul-Jabbar was coming on, and you didn't tell me when Tony Gonzalez, tight end for the Chiefs, was going, I missed those two, and now I'm going to miss Cranston? And I said, well, come into work with me, and you can ask him a question yourself. So,
Is he there?
He's coming in.
Good.
I'm going to do a spot, and then we'll take a millisecond break, and we'll come back, and Sonny Corolla will ask you his question he queued up. First, I'll tell you about Bet Online. No shortage of action coming up with our exclusive partner, BetOnline.ag, MLB, NBA. They're all back. Plus, UFC, you got a big fight coming up on Saturday. Stay tuned. After this podcast, as Fox Sports analyst Chris Myers talks to BetOnline's Dave Mason about returning sports and what that's going to look like in the next coming months. Need more? BetOnline has simulated NFL, NBA, and UFC daily. Also, hundreds of live casino games, poker tournaments, best props in the business. Visit BetOnline.ag, our exclusive partner at Podcast One. Don't forget, promo code PODCAST1 for your sign-up bonus today. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts. That's betonline.ag. All right, take a quick break. We'll come right back with Cranston and Sonny Corolla and his question right after this.
It's time to check Adam's voicemail.
Hey, Corolla, real quick, man. If you could expound on, is it a lateral move or is it an upgrade to move from Queens, New York, to Fontana, California? This is what I have done, and this is the situation I'm in. I'm sure you could do 10 minutes on it, the pros and the cons from each one. Please, let me hear it. Later.
You can leave us a message at 888-634-1744.
Well, it's actually a downgrade, but Fontana has a giant racetrack that I've been to many times with Sonny Corolla, actually. So if you're into NASCAR or Indy, then it's we can salvage your slightly downward move. Sonny Corolla.
Hi.
Meet Mr. Brian Cranston.
Nice to meet you, Mr. Cranston. It's good to see, you know, get a FaceTime you.
Oh, Cranston
I think he's muted.
We'll unmute him. Sorry.
Oh, someone muted me?
No, we got you. Sorry.
There we go. Hi, nice to meet you, Sonny.
Thank you. Good to meet you.
Sonny Corolla. Sonny Corolla sounds like a character that Joe Pesci would play in a movie.
Right? Well, you know what's interesting? My name is Adam Corolla, which doesn't really connote any ethnicity, you know what I mean? So the Corolla sounds Italian, but Adam sounds Jewish. At least when I grew up, the handful of Adams were Jewish. So my whole life, everyone would say to me, what kind of name is Corolla? And I'd go, what do you mean, what kind of name is Corolla? And I'd go, Adam Corolla? I don't know what that is. But it was the Adam that was throwing him off, because if my name was Tony Corolla, we'd have no problems. So when it came time to bring a child into the world, we thought, let's name him Santino. And that way people will know his heritage, right, Sonny Corolla?
Yeah, I think people know I'm Italian.
Do you have
been to Italy?
No, we were supposed to go this summer, but, you know.
You're going to love it. And if you trace back to see where your ancestors came from, Oh, you're gonna appreciate it even more. It's a beautiful country.
Thank you. Yeah, I was very excited about going. It looks like a nice place.
Yeah, his mom is full-blooded Italian, so both parents are from Italy. So Sonny's at the three-quarter mark because I'm half. All right, Sonny, had a question for Mr. Cranston.
Yeah, I had a few. What was the hardest scene to film in Breaking Bad, or of all time, maybe? And anything?
Well, there's a couple of them. There's a couple scenes late in the series where we're outside, and it's about 4 degrees, and you're shooting outside, and you could feel your body shaking from the cold and the condensation coming out of your mouth when you're speaking. But you can't act that. It was not about being cold. So you just have to really focus your mind and breath to just calm down, and then just do it. And then before your body convulses involuntarily from the cold, you know what that's like. You've been in really cold weather before, and then you get warm real quick. They come. It's a cut, and they run up and they throw a parka over you. And they just, and you jump into a van that's a warming van and just try to get your temperature up. And then they come and say, okay, ready for take two? And it's like, yeah, okay. And you rush out there and you do it over again. You do it several different times. That's a physical difficulty. But I think that the most difficulty that I had was, remember the... I think it was in season two when Jane died of an overdose.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Remember
yeah.
that?
Yeah.
Well, when I was preparing for that scene, I have a daughter who was her age, and I was preparing for that scene. And as I'm writing my notes for what could possibly be happening during that scene, as an actor would, and the possible emotions that you could be feeling at any given time, what I do is I write that all down, mm-hmm. and puts it in my brain, and then I let it go, so that if it pops up, it's real, it's spontaneous, and you got to deal with it. And one of the things that I wrote down was in a pro and con list about, should I save her life? Should I let her die? Mm-hmm. I really did. I wrote that down. Because that was the dilemma that Walter White was facing. And one of the reasons of I should save her life was she's young enough, she could be my daughter.
Oh.
And I wrote that down and then wrote other things down. Well, sure enough, one of the takes, I was there and looking at her, and Kristen Ritter, who played her, was beautiful and wonderful off camera acting full on for me, choking to death. And all of a sudden, her face just kind of melted away, and I saw the face of my real daughter
mm-hmm.
dying in front of me. And God forbid that ever happens to anyone that we know. It's the worst fear that a parent can have. It's not the natural order of things, you know, to see a child go. And so it scared me. And that's the take they used, where I'm shocked and I choke back an emotion because I saw my daughter's face instead. And I, in retrospect, I remembered, oh, it probably came to me because in the back of my head, I wrote down, she's young enough, she could be my daughter.
Oh, wow.
That was my most emotional, difficult scene to do.
He has some questions that he was going to ask Tony Gonzalez, but yeah, he never made it. So if you wouldn't mind answering a few of those just to kind of round out the kid's childhood.
Right. Len Dawson, you know, was there before I was able to get to Kansas City. You know, most people think that to do a down and out route is easy, but I'm telling you, you get slammed by that outside linebacker and, you know, you don't know what's up. And you got to focus on that spiral coming in and knowing full well you're going to get hit. But you got to focus on catching that ball and tucking it.
That's the Cynthia Seghetti training coming right out of Cranston. Yeah, Cynthia, God rest her soul. It was a funny, she was this big, loud woman, as you know. And she was kind of the Mama Cass Elliott of improvisational groundlings teachers. But she was like one of these people who was big and blustery. But you knew she had that heart of gold. But that was kind of her trademark, was yelling, you'd enter a scene and she'd go, okay, lights up, here we go. And you'd come walking out on stage and you'd go, hey man, what are you doing? And she'd yell, stop, you know what he's doing, turn around and come back in, don't ask questions, you know what he's doing. And then she'd go, lights up, and you'd come out again, and you'd walk out with your hands in your pockets, and you'd go, what did you bring to the party? And you'd go, I didn't bring, go back, come back again, tell you brought something to the party. And one time, Sonny, Daddy had girlfriends before Mommy. And
Bill does, don't he? No? Oh, no. Sure.
Just to stick with the before. No. Yeah. As a matter of fact, you're going to have to Uber home because I got to swing by Aunt Julia's house. My girlfriend dumped me. I know. Hard to imagine, right? And picture me, but broke. So you know what she was dealing with. And she dumped me, and it was like one of those times I was so upset. You know that when you're 23 and you get dumped kind of feeling that it's the worst misery ever. And I remember we took a break at the Groundlings with Cynthia Sagetti, and it was like intermediate or writer's lab or something like that. And I tried to call her with a payphone during the break, and she just pricked up, and she's like, said, stop calling, it's embarrassing, and hung up or whatever. And I went back into the class, and Cynthia was like, okay, everybody, let's get back up on stage. And I pulled her aside, and I just said, Cynthia, I just can't do it. I'm so heartbroken. I can't go up on stage and do comedy. I need to leave. And I just need to leave, and I just want to quietly leave. And if you could just tell people, I don't know, I got a cramp or something. Like, I'm just going to leave now, okay? And just tell them Adam wasn't feeling well. Italy. So I start walking out of the Groundlings, and Cynthia goes, well, Adam Carolla's leaving because his girlfriend dumped him. And everyone's looked at me. He's like, oh, the poor baby can't do comedy because he's not having a good day. Well, how's that going to work when you're not having a good day and you can't do comedy because your girlfriend dumped him? And everyone was just staring at me while I was standing in the doorway, the Groundlings. And I thought, you bitch. But I went back in and did comedy, and it was fine.
How were you?
I sucked. I have no recollection other than, God damn it, Cynthia, we had this whole conversation about me needing to sneak out of here and go in a corner somewhere.
In retrospect, were you appreciative that she said, you got to buck up and do it? Because sometimes, and Sonny, this is a good lesson, sometimes you have to do things and you don't feel like it. You got bad news or whatever. You don't feel like it. You don't feel strong, but you got to go in there and do it anyway. Certainly as an actor, or you have a stand-up gig, you can't just say, oh, my girlfriend broke up with me, I'm canceling.
Right.
Yeah.
You can't. Look, if you're a crane operator, you work at Trader Joe's, you can't do it either, really. It's not a bad lesson.
I fear more about the crane operator being distraught than the person working at Trader Joe's, just for obvious reasons.
It's a good point. Like, if that guy snaps, people are going to die, whereas Trader Joe's, you just don't get your banana chips in the right order in the bag. It's funny. Trader Joe's is a funny Inside Valley thing, because I remember Trader Joe's from 30 years ago, maybe more. Like, it was a novelty, nautical-themed market that always just seemed like kind of a novelty place, and now it's literally taken over the universe.
Yeah, with the Hawaiian shirts and the rope.
Yeah.
Rope
everywhere, and the guy checking you out was called Skipper, he had a fake parrot on his shoulder. Like, it was a bizarre, novel place. Yeah. It wasn't the go-to place. Like, you know how something has entered the lexicon is because when you hear pundits and politicians and stuff, and you hear them go, these guys, The teachers don't want to go back to work, but the guy who works at the Trader Joe's has to go into work every day. And it's like, oh, that it's mainstream. It used to be a novelty. It was a novelty market, and now it's a mainstream market. All right, Sonny, do you have any more questions for Mr. Cranston?
One more, one and a half.
All right.
What do you, I know this is probably like confidential, but are you maybe going to be on Better Call Saul season 5?
Well, season 5 is already produced and out there.
Oh, really?
Season six. Yeah. The real answer is that I don't know. I don't know. I love the series. I've been watching it, and I'm in the middle of season 5 right now, and it's really good, and it's its own entity. You know, there has some similar flavors of Breaking Bad, but it is its own show, and they do such a terrific job, and I'm very curious what's going to happen on season 6 when it's leading up to the point where Breaking Bad started. In the timeline,
mm-hmm.
I would do it in a second because I owe Vince Gilligan everything. So if Vince or Peter Gould, the showrunner, called and said, "Would you come on the show?" I'd say, "Absolutely, let's make it happen." That has not been the case to date. So and maybe it won't be, and that's fine too. So it depends, you know, whatever's best for the show and whatever they want to do.
All right, you got a half question left?
It's not really a half. I just wanted do you have a favorite line or scene from, like, as Walter White or Heisenberg?
Favorite line or scene? Some of these things came out that I didn't even know, like, "I'm the one who knocks," or "I am the danger," or "Say my name," or all those things that came out. But just so you can see.
Slide in the office chair.
I have the original hat.
Oh, you sunglasses. Have the outfit.
It is, So I stole it from the set.
Taken out of the Lucite box.
This is it. So now that's the original Heisenberg hat. And his glasses.
Oh, that's awesome.
Oh, look at that.
"Say my name, Sonny." But, yeah, it was a good time. I so appreciate it. Sonny, let me ask you a question, can I?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're 14.
Mm-hmm.
By now, you've started thinking, there are certain things that I'm interested in, and you've got high school right around the corner, and it's like, okay, so what am I thinking I'd like to do for a living when out of high school, out of college, and that sort of thing?
I don't know, something in the entertainment industry, mostly sports. I already started a podcast with some of the other people here. I thought maybe acting. I did drama for a little bit. That was really fun. I thought I was pretty good at it.
Huh?
Yeah, I think also something that like Stephen A. Smith, some like a talk show or like a commentating over a basketball game or a football game.
Right.
Is something that I'd want to do.
It combines your knowledge of sports plus your ability to communicate succinctly as you're doing now. And you have a very good voice. You have a good timbre to your voice.
Thank you.
All right, yeah. Sonny, hit the bricks, and thank Mr. Cranston.
Thank you, Mr. Cranston. It was good to meet you. Thanks, I hope Sonny. We get to meet some other time.
Good to meet you, Sonny. Take care. I'm sorry you have Adam as a father.
Sonny, sorry you have me as a father. Yeah, what a week. He just got back from Laguna Seca. We just did a car race at Laguna Seca last weekend, and now he's talking to his idol, Bryan Cranston. Thanks, Sonny. All right, let me hit Omega XL. Oh, man. I tell you, man, I was having some problems with my hands, some pain with my hands, and now they feel like they felt when I was in junior high. Sometimes people are having back pain, knee pain, neck pain, shoulder pain. Not a little of that, but Omega XL worked nicely. The underlying cause is inflammation. So you don't want to mask the pain. You want to take care of what is creating the pain, and that is inflammation. Backed by 35 years of clinical research, Omega XL attacks inflammation, and that's the stuff that causes the pain. So, again, the pain relievers and the topical rubs, it's just kind of spackling over the problem. Omega XL neutralizes inflammation, and that's what gets rid of the pain, the stiffness, and the joints. If you're suffering from aches, pains, and stiffness, you need to try Omega XL. Right, Dawson?
Order Omega XL now and get a second bottle free. Visit OmegaXL.com/Adam. That's OmegaXL.com/Adam. Or call 1-800-844-4888. 800-444-4888. 800-844-4888.
You know, it strikes me, I'm trying to think of how a show like Breaking Bad sort of captures a zeitgeist. And I think it's through just being that good. And I know maybe you're not going to take all the credit for that. But I'm saying is it about a theme? Is it about a story? Or is it just about being that good? Like these days, like, are we at a point now where you can't buy your way into success? You know, when I was a kid, it was like you bought enough commercials, I'd go out and see the movie. Didn't matter if the movie was good or bad. It was the one that was in the local movie house, the El Portal or the Lorena or the Guild. I think there was one called the Guild. But it was whatever. They could take my money. They didn't have to be that good. But I'm thinking now, I don't think you can buy your way into success now. I think it's about the product.
Well, you know, there's several reasons for that. First of all, audiences are far more sophisticated now than they ever have been. And that's because the product has improved greatly. When I was 25 years old, living in New York, I was a series regular on a soap opera for a couple years. And there were 16 soap operas on the air at the time. That was the heyday of it. The production value and the quality of the writing isn't that good. And not necessarily because the people weren't talented, but just they had to churn it out. They had to punch out 60 pages every day. And it was like, wow, it was just an amazing exercise. So you look at, and the production values weren't that good. Now, why are there only four soaps left in the world? And those are just barely hanging on because the production value has risen. The expectations for quality has risen. And we watch it when we watch it. The demand and the struggle to get eyeballs to watch your show is enormously pressured. But also with what you're saying, the element of the talent of Vince Gilligan to write a story that strikes a chord with so many people, that here's a teacher who has to have a side job because his son has special needs. That's not right. Not only that, he's going to die of cancer. That's not right. And you know what? He uses his skill as a chemist to make crystal meth, become a criminal for the last 2 years of his life. And you know what? As much as they hate to admit it, a lot of people were going, you know what? I'd probably do the same thing. I'd do whatever it took to set my family up. If I was going out, maybe it's a very male thing. You want to have some kind of control of your destiny. And that's the way I looked at it. Like Walter White was just doing that because he controlled his destiny. If Walter White was a mathematician, he would figure out a way to cheat at blackjack and go to Vegas,
right?
Instead of making crystal meth. It just happened to be what he was good at. So he becomes this accidental criminal, and he realizes on the course of it, oh my God, I'm finally doing something that is well respected. I've never had that before. Ironic that it's illegal, but he's still getting credit for it, for making the purest methamphetamine. So you have all these elements that people are related. They're rooting for the guy who is struggling. They're rooting for the guy who's just trying to do this for his family. And then the hook is that he evolves into a guy who's no longer doing it just for his family. He's doing it for himself.
Speaking
of, too late to shake the and spit the hook.
Speaking of dads who are doing it for their family, I know you and your brother sort of got reacquainted with your dad at a, was it 22 or he left when you were about 11 or 12, I guess. Was he just gone completely for that period of time?
Yeah, we didn't see him for about 10 years.
Physically didn't lay eyes on him for 10 years.
Right.
Is there, right. I don't know, you know, how much therapy you've been through, but that message of I'm not going to see my 12-year-old, 11-year-old sons for a decade, is there any more negative message that can be sent? You know, I've always kind of felt that, I always felt like if you were in, you know, if you had a crush on a girl and she would walk up to you and punch you in the stomach, that was still better than her not knowing you were alive, right? And
exactly.
The parents who, you know, parents can be horrible and they can be abusive and they can be verbally abusive and physically abusive. And they can do everything. But pretending like your kids aren't alive, I don't know. That's the hardest gut punch ever, right?
It was. And it's taken a long time to get to the point of dealing with my resentment and anger and abandonment issues. And I have no qualms about it. Yes, I've gone to therapy. I still go to therapy. And it's like a process. Now, has that helped me in my acting life? Well, I use it. If you want anger or resentment or rage or, I can give you that, you know, because I lived it. And, but I want to compartmentalize it. I want it at work, but I don't want it at home. And I've done really well doing that, if I might say so. It's like, and the only way to survive a long marriage like I have is to be able to know how to do that. But like you, boxing, acting is an outlet for me. It's a physical and emotional, intellectual outlet. I purge when I do it, whether it's on stage or in a movie or series. I give it everything because I need to. I don't know how not to give it all. I have to give it all and spend it and be exhausted afterward because it's also good for me. It allows me, it gives me an avenue, a venue to be able to get rid of that stuff and have it, you know, be effective.
Is it almost like a lactic acid or poison or something that is built up in your muscles? And if you don't purge, it'll just keep accumulating. Does it kind of feel that way?
Everyone needs a physical release. You have to find, is it boxing? Is it running? Is it yoga? Is it, you know, Zumba? Whatever your thing is, you've got to find an outlet so that you can sweat, so that you can purge yourself of toxins and drink water and get rid of that lactic acid.
I'm curious about, I've been very curious lately, just in general, on the subject of self-esteem. And I was interviewing Jay Leno in the studio a few weeks back, and he was sort of explaining he doesn't really have self-esteem, but it's not really a negative. He just goes about his life, you know. And I kind of realized I don't really have self-esteem either. I just go about my life. I don't feel a self-esteem, and it, not in a, you know, feel sorry for me boo-hoo negative way. Just I don't factor myself in to a lot of the situations in life. And I feel like sometimes people focus too much on themselves in this way. And I was thinking to myself, it's hard to have self-esteem when you grow up like I grew up or like you grew up. And some of it is kind of chemical. Some of it is just kind of who you are. There's people that feel really good about themselves for no apparent reason, and there's people that don't, sort of chemically or biologically. But for you, what do you feel about your self-esteem? I mean, have you thought about it? And again, low self-esteem, I'm not saying that's a negative per se. That sometimes can be helpful. But have you ever given that subject consideration?
I think self-reflection is important. You know, when I used to, that working class sensibility is ingrained in us. And when I was on Malcolm in the Middle, and I would meet fans, and they would say, "I've never met a TV star before," and I would, "Oh no, no, no! I'm just a working actor. No, 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 no." And I would spend all this energy trying to deny what they wanted to call me, and I got in the way. It did several things. It wasn't true because apparently I was. But secondly, by denying someone's statement of "you're a star," it forces them to double down and say, "No, yes, you are."
It's right.
So the communication gets a little tougher, and it's like, "No, no, really, yes, you are. No, no, yeah, yeah." And I finally realized, what am I pushing against? I'm like Sisyphus trying to get the rock up the hill. Why don't I just say, "Oh, thank you," and it's over.
Yeah, so
for you to recognize your talent and where you've come and how far you've gone and what you've created is not necessarily self-esteem as it is recognition of, oh yeah, you're a star, you have notoriety, and you have financial security, and those are good things. And just say thank you and move on.
I always sort of looked at it as when people would come up and say hi at the airport or something like that. I just thought, if you're going to be on MTV every night for an hour, this is what people are going to do. So they're kind of saying hi to the person they see on TV every night. You don't have to talk them out of it. It's just the way our society works. You know, you don't have to run for it. You don't have to run toward it or away from it. If you're going to be on TV for an hour every night, then people are X amount of society will recognize you walking through LAX, and a certain percentage of them will say something.
And I will seek privacy as often as I possibly can. So I will wear a hat and keep my head down. And I usually, when I'm with my family, I'll go into a restaurant when things are normal, and I'll take the seat that's facing the wall, because chances are we will be able to have a more normal experience at dinner than if I'm recognized and people come up. Then it just changes the energy around, and I don't want to do that. I want to compartmentalize when I'm working, what I'm working on, and when I'm free and home and spend my time with my wife, my daughter, and friends and things like that. So like right now, on the promotional tour for the one and only Ivan, it's my work mode. I know what I'm doing, and I'll go out there and I'll work as much as I possibly can to support something, a film in this case, that I really love and I want people to see. And when it's over, I step back and I become reclusive, and I don't want to be in the limelight. I don't want to be on shows. So, you know, I mean, I listened to your podcast. I'll listen to the podcast, but I won't listen to this podcast. Because I've done it, and I don't want to hear myself. I want to hear someone. I want to hear someone who I don't know that much and see what their life is like.
Well, Tony Gonzalez is coming into the studio. No, this is stupid. Last question, Brian. Writing and creating. How much of that? How big a part of your life is that right now? And what's the process or the protocol or how does it work? Because I know a lot about a lot of people, but I never really know how much writing they're doing or creating they're doing.
I write a lot. I wrote a book a couple of years ago, a memoir of short stories, and I really had a great time doing that. I might want to write another one or attempt to do a novel or something or a play. I like to do things to test myself to see if I'm any good at it. And I may not be, but I like to try to see if I am and if I enjoyed the experience. And I enjoyed writing this book. I've written several episodes of television, mostly my own that I created for there was a series called Dangerous Book for Boys that I wrote on, and I created the show. And there was a series called Sneaky Pete that I wrote on and created that show as well. So I'm interested in not only writing for other characters, but for myself, or I'm also, I love to produce because it's then I get to support the writer, your vision. Let's see how I can pave the way for that writer to find their voice. And I think it's pretty exciting, but it takes a lot of energy. It takes a lot of energy to write and produce and act and direct. And it's like, at some point I think I might be like Dick Shawn doing stand-up comedy, and all of a sudden he falls flat on his face and dies on stage. And everybody thought he was doing a routine. It's like, no, wait, don't go out there. Don't go out there. He's doing something.
Right. I think.
No, he's not.
Coming full circle, Dick Shawn, was he in Mad World, or is that Dick? Not Dick Gray.
Gaudier?
No. I'll look at my producer, Chris. Was Dick Shawn.
Yeah, it's Dick Shawn.
Dick Shawn was this big, funny, strapping kind of dude who was in the Mad World, was he in San Diego when he dropped dead out on stage, or I think that Albert Brooks and Bob Einstein, I think, and Super Dave Osborne, I think their dad was a comedian or performer who died up on stage.
Oh, no kidding.
Well, I think. Yeah, San Diego was Dick Shawn, right? Can you figure out, I love the computer, the dad, Super Dave's, Albert Brooks' dad. Yeah. And was that the...
It is funny. I think I remember hearing the story of Carl Reiner going on Johnny Carson's show and saying, the smartest kid I know is a kid named Albert Einstein.
Oh, really? Yeah, who was Albert Brooks.
Albert Brooks. Yeah.
Yeah. So Harry Einstein died from a heart attack in 1958 during a roast in honor of Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz.
So died on stage on the dais in a Lucy roast.
He's trying, is there more of a comedian trying to get more attention? It's just like, it's like, wow. All right, you win. You win.
You get the most. In a weird way, maybe we should all go up on stage telling a joke. The movie, I should tell everyone one more time, The One and Only Ivan. It's a very touching movie and a very good movie, and it premieres on Disney Plus Friday, August 21st. And also, you can shoot Brian a tweet or an Instagram at Brian Cranston as well. And let's not forget the Mezcal brand tequila. Is it Mezcal tequila, or is it just Mezcal?
Mezcal.
Dos Hombres. Where can you get Dos Hombres?
Man, you can get it almost there. You can get it through Drizzly, and they'll send it right to your house, or Total Wine and Spirits, or BevMo. We're all over the place. We're at Gelston's and Safeways, and we're doing really well. It's a beautiful juice. And some night we should have a toast. We'll have some mangria and some Dos Hombres.
Well, you got to be careful. I know where you live, so I might just show up there and have a little toast. And you can give me some of those magic platelets you have. Brian, always a thrill, always a treat. One of the good ones, Brian Cranston. Thanks so much for joining us, Brian.
Thanks, Adam. Good to talk to you, man.
We'll talk soon. All right, let me hit LifeLock here. Fraudsters are sending messages through the social media, emails, a Cash App scam. It's all there. The messages offer free money via the app. Help during this difficult time. It's so sad that these people are trying to take advantage of folks during this pandemic. It's important to understand how cybercrime and identity theft are affecting our lives. Every day, we put our info at risk on the internet. You can miss certain identity threats if you're just monitoring your credit alone. you need LifeLock. LifeLock detects a wide range of identity threats, like your social security number for sale on the dark web. You have access to dedicated restoration specialists, and they'll be right on your case if you become a victim. They're the best. They're LifeLock, right, Dawson?
No one can prevent all identity theft or monitor all transactions at all businesses. LifeLock can see threats you might miss on your own. Join now and save up to 25% off your first year by using promo code Adam. Call 1-800-LifeLock or head to LifeLock.com. Use promo code Adam for 25% off.
All right. Well, you can go to AdamCarolla.com, find out the live shows. Possibly, I think Tempe Improv, September 18th and 19th is still on, so you can get some tickets to that. You can check out the YouTube channel, youtube.com/Adam Carolla, if you like. I'm your emotional support animal. My book is available on Amazon, and you can bookmark us and click through and leave a review. I'll read it. Until next time, it's Adam Carolla for Gina and Bald and Brian Cranston saying mahalo.
Follow the Adam Carolla Show on Twitter at Adam Carolla Show. Follow us on Twitter at Adam Carolla. Leave us a voicemail at 888-634-1744 and get Adam's book, I'm Your Emotional Support Animal. It's available everywhere. The links are at AdamCarolla.com.
Hey, this is Chris Myers, and I have a new podcast coming soon to Podcast One. CMI, the Chris Myers interview. I hope you listen for it. Be glad for you to join us. But today, excited to be chatting with Dave Mason of Bet Online. You know, sports are back, finally back, and filtering through. And we're excited that they are back. And Dave, it's exciting to talk to you. So tell us what kind of action there is with a lot of stuff going on at one time.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a challenging few months. You know, we went from promoting Russian ping pong and marble racing and all this other crazy stuff I had never in my wildest dreams. I thought I'd be handicapping. But now, you know, we got the NBA's back. The playoffs are almost here. NHL, MLB with their shortened regular season. And NFL's right around the corner. College football, we'll see. But if we're planning on it, if it's here, we'll all the odds for it.
Yeah, and I think we're all kind of waiting to see, so you better move on it quickly because seasons could be shortened or altered. And, yeah, it really has been missed, just the excitement of kind of involving yourself. How about, you know, baseball with extra teams getting into the postseason, and you mentioned the shortened season. I mean, we know about Yankees, Dodgers, we know the favorites, but there has to be a chance of good opportunities for some sleeper teams that might have better pitching that just get in the door and then all of a sudden work their way to maybe a major upset and make it to the World Series.
Yeah, no, and we saw that. You know, we saw that ever since, you know, we've had the World Series odds up all throughout, you know, the months where sports were kind of down, but we still had all the futures up. And we saw that as news of the sports coming back and their shortened seasons. And teams were taking, I mean, because sharp bettors and more intelligent bettors, they were taking shots on the longer odd teams, you know. So we were seeing that left and right. The same thing, you know, the more games there are, everything's going to even out, right? But the shorter the season is, no matter the sport, or the shorter the games in a series or whatever, there's that more of a anything can happen. Kind of like March Madness, one and done, right? That's why you always have those Cinderella stories. But if, you know, March Madness series were all seven games, then the Cinderellas would be few and far between. So that's kind of the same theory here, why a lot of bettors are taking more shots at these long shots than before.
Yeah, I mean, you could have the Yankees or Dodgers run in, and remember that first playoff series. There's no one wild card. It's three games, and they're all in one ballpark. Now, again, home field advantage in baseball already iffy, but now the current situation that could change things. And then also, you know, risk of injury is always a factor, but here you have health issues that a star pitcher or star player, right, could be out of the mix, and that upsets everything.
No, absolutely, and that's another great point, and another reason why I think people are betting long shots more than ever in World Series. You know, it's that just evens the playing field. That you know, no one's going to be immune to catching this. You know, a star player can catch it from the Yankees just as much as a star player can catch it from the Pirates. So, it's going to even the playing field a lot if some of these star players from the Yankees, Dodgers, Twins, Braves, etc., start catching this thing. So without a doubt.
All right, America Runs on Football. The NFL, if any, I think will just go straight forward ahead, and they'll adjust. And simply when there were health problems at baseball, nobody folded the tents. They kept it going, and we're on target for a regular season. I know they have backup plans, maybe a shortened season, whatever, but we're good to go. And I know people who love to get involved in this, they got to be excited, and maybe things go up too quickly. You know, you don't win the offseason, but when Tom Brady is in Tampa Bay, or Phillip Rivers in Indianapolis, even, you know, I'm intrigued by how people are interested in the Patriots, who are always the Patriots, but without Brady, and now Cam Newton or Jared Stidham, whoever Belichick goes with, that's got to create a lot of excitement and anticipation.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, all that Brady news to the Bucs came down after, I guess, all the sports got nuked a few months back. And that was an exciting week for us because, you know, we were just starving for action on the sports side of things. And then stuff like that happens, and all of a sudden people are betting the NFL futures. You know, they were betting the Buccaneers to win the Super Bowl. They're betting, you know, the Bills to win the AFC East. They're betting under season wins for Patriots, over season wins for Buccaneers. So we saw a lot of action coming in that week. So yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Buccaneers we have such a huge exposure on the Buccaneers to win the Super Bowl. I've never seen anything like it in all my years doing this. So that's the bettors are hyped on the Buccaneers. I mean, they were like, I think they were like 40-1 before people thought that Brady was going to go there. When the rumors started coming out, it was right down to 25-1 all the way down to, I think we have them like 8-1 or 9-1 now. They're probably overvalued, but you know, our exposure is just so big on them that we have to be a little conservative with their number.
Yeah, and it really grew. And here's, yeah, he's coming to, he was in one place all this time, to a new team with a lot of talent in Tampa Bay and a different coach. And yet without a preseason, you wonder, of course, he's an experienced veteran, but the timing and settling, and that'll be fun to watch. All right, before we wrap real quick, I mean, we could go on and on, but the NFC West is intriguing. And I always like, it's a simple thing, you know, the over under on wins, right, based on teams. And I think where the defending NFC champions come from, the 49ers, you know, obviously you've got Seattle with Russell Wilson. And you have the Rams, who were in the Super Bowl a couple of years ago, and I don't think they're as down as people think. I think they're going to surprise some people getting back up there. And then Kyler Murray and what they've done in Arizona. I mean, that division, it's a hard over-under because they're going to be playing each other twice a year, beating each other up.
No, you're absolutely right. And four teams that could legitimately win it. That Cardinals is a great example of how action came in. I mean, they're our most popular bet for over wins for the season. I think they're at 7.5 right now. And a lot of that came in when Hopkins got traded there and action just started piling in on the Cardinals. And yeah, the bettors are a pro 49ers, pro Seahawks, pro Cardinals. They're down on the Rams though, but I don't know how you can sleep on the Rams, you know, 2 years out of the Super Bowl. So that's going to be a fun watch without a doubt.
All right. Thanks, Dave. Appreciate the time. Be sure to check out Bet Online. They're your online sportsbook experts, and use promo code podcast1. That's spelled O-N-E, podcast, and then O-N-E, podcast1. And you'll, when you join, you'll get a sign up bonus.